From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America has become the world capital of obesity. More than a third of American adults now obese, 17% of our children. It burdens lives and costs the country. Now the pushback, giant sodas out in New York, McDonald's posting calories, and individuals and communities trying to turn it around. This hour on Point, what works for resetting a population's waistline? We'll look at Oklahoma City's effort and beyond. You can join the conversation. Eat less, move more is true. But how do we drive home the message? How do we get a society to change? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Board of Health giving a green light to Mayor Michael Bloomberg's ban on big sweet drinks. It comes into effect next spring. He's been pushing for it for months now. Yesterday, after the New York City Board of Health approved the ban on sales of sodas and other sugary drinks over 16 ounces, Mayor Bloomberg told members of the press the action was necessary.
We've taken bold action in New York City because obesity is a national epidemic that's getting worse, and we're not just going to wring our hands about it.
Well, but there is plenty of skepticism out there. In May, when Mayor Bloomberg first introduced the idea of a ban on the sale of the big sodas, Comedy Central's The Daily Show host Jon Stewart had some biting remarks for the mayor.
I love this idea you have of banning sodas larger than 16 ounces. It combines the draconian government overreach people love with the probable lack of results they expect.
Oh, puts the knife right in. We're going to start out today in Oklahoma City. Oklahoma ranks as one of the heaviest states in the country. The mayor of Oklahoma City is Mayor Mick Cornett. He decided to try to do something about it in his community, to put the city on a diet, as he put it, to go door to door to push healthier living. Mayor Cornett joins us now from Oklahoma City, Republican, first elected in 2004. Mayor Cornett, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
So you are a big popular mayor. You get all kinds of accolades for being, a terrific mayor. And here you are going after this. Why this? I mean, you've got a lot on your plate. What pushed you to make this a big issue, Mayor?
Well, back in 2005, 2006, we started showing up on a lot of really great lists, you know, best places to get a job, best places to do business, those types of things.
Yep.
And then came out the list of the most obese cities in the country. And that surprised me. It embarrassed me and many others in the city. And then I realized that I was really an example of the problem, that I'd allowed my own weight to get away from me. I'd gained 10 pounds a year in the first 2 years I was mayor, and that I was obese, by definition.
Okay.
And so I took care of my issues, and then I came up with an idea of creating an awareness campaign that I thought could begin the cultural shift that I thought was necessary.
So, I mean, we know it's not easy, and we know you're still in a state. I'm looking here. These are numbers from August. Oklahomans, obesity rate going up since 2010, not down. So statewide, it's still in the heavy side of the range there. As a mayor with one city, how do you begin? What have you done?
Well, we started with this awareness campaign. I went to the zoo and I stood in front of the elephants and I said, this city is going on a diet and we're going to lose 1 million pounds. And ultimately, well, we had 47,000 people take part in our web-generated program, and the 1 million pounds was lost after 4 years and 3 weeks. So that was in January of this year. And then Men's Fitness Magazine, the same magazine that had named us one of the fattest cities 4 years ago that kind of launched it, had their new study out, and we were on the fittest cities list in the country. We were no longer on the fattest list. So
congratulations.
The city is doing better. Our per capita income is going up, and that helps as well. And we followed up the awareness campaign with a number of infrastructure improvements to completely redesign the city's infrastructure to be more friendly to people and pedestrians than it was to cars.
How? Like what?
Well, we're redesigning all of our downtown streets to be more narrow, to be more highly landscaped. We had built a city that was completely designed for the automobile. We have a lot of urban sprawl issues. We have a lot of fast food restaurants. And we're building hundreds of miles of new sidewalks. We're completing our bicycle trail master plan, which will be over 100 miles. We're building senior health and wellness centers throughout the city. We're building large urban parks in the downtown area to serve as community gathering places. So the infrastructure changes, I think, are necessary. If we're really going to have a cultural shift, it's not just the information people need and the awareness and the ability to talk and have a conversation about obesity, but you've got to have infrastructure changes as well.
And there's more that you're doing. We'll talk about it. How are people responding to the, you know, it hasn't been the greatest times. How are they responding to the outlays on infrastructure that you're describing there? How are Oklahoma City residents receiving that?
Well, positively. In fact, they voted for it all. We put it into large initiatives with expiring taxes, and they've allowed them to keep going to fund most of the projects that I mentioned to you. And so we have over $1 billion of infrastructure changes in place right now in Oklahoma City, and our economy is really strong. We have the lowest unemployment in the country, probably the strongest economy per capita of anywhere in the country.
What's driving your economy these days, Mr. Mayor? Is it natural gas or what?
Well, that's certainly a major part of it. We diversified about 20 years ago and made sure that we weren't so reliant on the energy industry, and we've made some great investments in aviation and biomedical and tourism. But in general, I think it's the infrastructure investments that we've made to recreate the city. We have a number of highly educated 20-somethings that are moving to the city that are making the entrepreneurs and the job creators successful. The Kauffman Foundation recently noted that we were the most entrepreneurial city in the country with the most startups per capita.
Good
so
for you.
Now, the attraction of human capital is the key.
That's great. Now, the Affordable Care Act comes in here, what some people call Obamacare, and it has money to encourage healthier living. How does that come into your campaign?
Well, our campaign has gone on in spite of it. It really hasn't been...
In spite of it? Aren't you receiving money from it?
Well, we are generally, I think our state turned down the bulk of the money that would have come in a year or two ago. But, there's still some programming that would ultimately help people in Oklahoma City. And if the money is going to be spent, I'm not against us accepting it. I think going forward, you know, that money is drying up. Federal money for cities is drying up, and it's only cities that are proactively creating their own infrastructure projects that are going to succeed. And the reason we're attracting that human capital today is for the quality of life.
Mayor Cornett, as a Republican, are you unable to speak directly to how you're going to use a portion of the money from the health care reform? Are you uncomfortable doing that? You are going to use it, aren't you?
Well, I mean, it doesn't come to mayors.
I thought that money was going to be involved in your anti-obesity, a pro-health, heart health campaign in Oklahoma City.
Well, the City-County Board of Health is taking some of that money to help build a campus, and we may build some things that are in association with it, but we're not in the funding stream in the traditional sense that you would think. It goes through states, it goes through counties, and sometimes it even goes through schools. But I don't think there's any of the money that's going directly to cities.
Oh, but I understood that your zip code 73111, a part of Oklahoma City that's got a particularly tough health profile, is going to be targeted for this health awareness, to get people on a better path. Is that not the case?
No, that's exactly right. We're working with the City-County Board of Health, and we are microscopically looking at that lowest performing zip code and trying to figure out how we can get better. We've contracted with Gallup to come in and try to make our programming more effective. But it's about information and it's about access, and we're trying to take care of both of those projects.
And this is one of the lowest income parts of the city. And what will that campaign look like on the streets, Mayor Cornett?
Well, I think the first thing we're trying to take care of is the access. You know, there are food deserts in parts of our city and every other city, and typically they're in low-income areas, places that don't have great access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And they may not have access to wellness centers, you know, if you can give them health information or give them a place to exercise. And so we're trying to take care of that part, too. The reason that Gallup would be coming in is to try and help fill in the missing links, because I suspect that it's not just information and just access that's leaving these people in situations where health is not what it should be. We're determined to push the bar, and whatever level of success we'd have normally, we intended to make it better.
The Affordable Care Act carved out $10 billion, which is on its way since the Supreme Court upheld it this summer, to go into this kind of education for communities, for this kind of drive to raise health awareness. Are you glad to have that money coming into your streets? What about John Stewart's, you know, sort of scoffing at government efforts when it comes to health and weight reduction?
I think the federal government needs to be spending less money. for the reasons that are pretty obvious.
But it's going to be at work on your city's streets. Are you welcoming that?
If the money is going to be spent, I want Oklahoma City residents to get their share. But the money that we're spending on our streets is local money, voted in by our local taxpayers.
This is really interesting. So how do you end up feeling then? You decide you had a crisis. Do you think that the government, federal, state, local, should be involved in helping solve it when it comes to obesity?
Yes. I think we should be part of the process.
Can you spend less and be equipped to address it?
Well, what I think we're doing here locally is pretty proactive and you know what we're comfortable doing. You know, when it comes to the federal money, that's pretty much out of my hands. But if the money is coming, then I think we ought to use it to the best ability that we can.
Your state governor, Mary Fallon, turned away $54 million in money to help prepare for the new law. But you're not turning it away in Oklahoma City. Why? Because you've got a problem? You want to use whatever resource you've got?
Well, the money's not coming to the city, but the City-County Board of Health is a partner of ours, and they're accepting money. But that's really just a branch of the state.
But it will be at work on your streets. Are you glad for that?
Oh, absolutely.
Mayor Mick Cornett of Oklahoma City joining us today. Mayor, thanks very much for your time.
You bet, Tom.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about New York's big gulp ban, McDonald's calorie count, and what to really do about America's obesity rate. Also with us right now from Oklahoma City is Michael Bailey. He's a county health worker in the Oklahoma City County Health Department. He's been going door to door in Oklahoma City's poorest neighborhood promoting the city's health initiative, My Heart, My Health, My Family. Michael Bailey, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
It's great to have you here. And also with us today, from New Haven, Connecticut, Kelly Brownell. He's professor of epidemiology and public health, director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University, co-author of Food Fight, author of the Learn Program for Weight Management 2000, former president of the Society of Behavioral Medicine. Kelly Brownell, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Kelly, first to you. I mean, nationally, it's so interesting here. We've got money put aside in the health care reform, the Affordable Care Act, $10 billion for health care prevention of dangerous behavior, obesity, and all the rest. That money will be at work in Oklahoma City. You heard the mayor kind of peddling away from that fact in spite of the fact that he's embraced a big anti-obesity campaign in his city. What do you make of that, Kelly?
Well, what I was most encouraged by is that we're seeing more and more officials at all levels of government, including the city level, mm-hmm. interested in doing things about the obesity problem. That's a very good sign, and it's been the case only relatively recently. So the mayor's effort to bring awareness to the problem, to create infrastructure changes, are all very positive developments, and I'm totally in support of that. And if federal money can help support it, it's all for the better.
Well, think more about how that gets applied. Michael Bailey, you're there in Oklahoma City, and you're going street by street. Now, I'm reading here News 9 out of Oklahoma City saying the city has received a big chunk of money from the Affordable Care Act, $790,000 a year for 5 years, to raise awareness about the dangers of obesity. Describe your work for us, Michael. What are you doing?
Well, what I'm trying to do is I go out in zip code 73111, and I try to convince people to enroll in the program, to take advantage of the free medical care, and, of course, also to change their lifestyle, to add activity and change what the way of eating is also part of the program.
Now, is this My Heart, My Health, My Family? Is that the program you're working on, Michael?
Yes, it is.
So what is offered under this? I'm looking here. This looks like it was put out from the city or the county health centers. Free doctor visits, free lab tests, free medication. For whom, Michael?
Okay. Well, first thing, you must live in 73111, and you have to be between the ages of 35 and 60.
Okay.
Now, if you do meet those criteria, then you get a free medical test. And if you happen to suffer from obesity, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or high blood sugar or diabetes, Then you also get free medical care and seeing a doctor at least four times a year, totally free, there's no copay. And you also get free medication with no copay. And we'll even go as far as if you need transportation problems, we will come to your house, pick you up for your appointments, and take you back home.
Now, this is a part of the city, a low-income part of the city, where heart problems are at a 10 times the rate of in the healthiest part of the city. What kind of reception are you getting, Michael, when you're trying to do this? Do people want to hear about it or not?
Generally, people on a general level want to hear about it, and they think it's a really great program. It's just getting people to take that personal responsibility and to enroll themselves in that program and to take that time and to be concerned about that. And that's the only problem we're running into.
So out of, 100 people you talk to, how many do you think are really taking steps to change their lifestyle, change their weight?
Well, I think the more you talk to people, the more it gets on their mind and I think they're taking small steps. We have several other campaigns going on also as far as Rethink Your Drink. What's also offered in this program is a 12-week, which is also free, course where we talk about eating, what you eat, and your activity, and we try to change your behavior. So it's being received really well, and I think in the long run it's going to really make a difference.
Kelly Brownell, when this $10 billion was put into the Affordable Care Act, there were Republicans in Congress who called it a slush fund, very kind of disdainful of it. What does your research tell you about how much influence, I mean, everybody's worried about this, everybody's thinking about it, but how much influence government money like this can have in changing people's weight, their health profile?
Well, it's too bad government didn't pony up multiples of that amount to help address prevention problems. The country doesn't pay much attention to prevention. We like to try to treat things once they come about. And prevention is such a wiser use of money in many cases because, well, obvious reasons. But the country just doesn't think that way typically. So I would have supported even more money. Now, how it gets used when it gets into communities is interesting. And, God bless Oklahoma City for what they're doing. And some of what I heard from the mayor I really like, but I probably would have spent at least some of the money differently. So taking people one by one, trying to encourage them to change their behavior once they have these health-related problems is extremely difficult, and you can go through all your money in a short time and help relatively few people. So I think it's much better to change the environmental drivers of the problem that affect millions of people at the same time rather than to work with people one at a time, because it's very hard to change these lifestyle habits. And the mayor boasted about the million pounds lost. Well, how many of those million pounds are regained already or will be? And these are tough problems people face.
Your center at Yale, the Rudd Center there, it came out with research saying that, as I understand it, that anti-obesity campaigns that are viewed as stigmatizing actually instill less motivation to improve health. So what does that say about going door to door and calling on people to do things better? Is that stigmatizing or is that an invitation to do better?
Oh, I don't see what I've heard from Oklahoma City. I haven't been there and visited, but I haven't heard anything that would make me wonder about stigmatizing effects. In Georgia, there was a campaign that was very visible around the state that I thought was really quite stigmatizing and discourages people from changing
their behavior. How? Why? What went on?
Well, there's a sort of common idea that if you direct bias and stigma at overweight people, that it will motivate them and actually help the obesity problem. But the opposite tends to occur. People tend to feel discouraged, embarrassed, humiliated. And one of the reactions to that is to get worse health care, to eat more, to exercise less, and you can exacerbate the problem. But I didn't hear any of that from the Oklahoma City description, and I think you can easily go door to door, encourage healthy lifestyle habits without embarrassing people, and I think it could be done in a sensitive way. Again, I'm not so sure that's the way I would spend the money, but I haven't heard anything that would concern me about stigma.
Mr. Bailey in Oklahoma City, what are you finding works in terms of message? What's the most persuasive case that you've found for getting people to, try and get a grip on their weight for their heart health? And what doesn't work, Mr. Bailey?
Well, I'll tell you what doesn't work is the normal advertising. Initially, when we had this program, we sent out letters to every household in 73111. We got very little response. We had some TV, radio. We got very little response. You know, there are historical issues in that neighborhood as far as trust. And that's where I come in. I actually grew up in the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
and I can go out and talk to people and assure them that this is in their best interest. And of course, in neighborhoods where there are food deserts such as this, and where there are other concerns such as, you know, eating, transportation, jobs, paying the rent, many times health care takes a back seat to that. And it's not that they're not concerned. They just do not have that money. That's the money doesn't trickle down to healthcare. And so by us going in and assuring them that this is a really good program, there are no catches to it, I'm getting a pretty good response. I mean, the people who go through the program, I've interviewed them after the fact, and they've been very, very pleased with it. And of course, our classes we give, the people there are also very pleased.
Do they weigh less?
Yes, they actually, our goal, which is one of the things we say, is you have to make a goal that is realistic. And our goal is only for you to lose 5% of your weight in the first 12 weeks. And we have lots of people who achieve that goal.
I'm looking here at one. Terry Long, 51 years old, cashier at a grocery store, saying she lost 15 pounds. After cutting out her favorite foods, chocolate donuts and pork rinds, that might help. Let's get our listeners in here. Peter in Memphis, Tennessee. Peter, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to take a completely diametrically opposed view. I think we're at the point of absurdity. I'm almost laughing about this entire discussion.
At point of absurdity, you see the obesity, I imagine. You know what it costs us in terms of people's lives and health care. Isn't that a serious issue, Peter?
When you say it costs us, that's because you're running everything through a governmental, centralized planning management perspective. Individuals are responsible for their own lives. And these kind of crises that are fabricated and become promoted through the media are passing top phenomena.
I mean, yeah, but you know, even if you're on private insurance and, you know, you've got a lot of people who are overweight end up in the hospital, you know, we all end up paying for that in our private insurance, don't we?
That's possibly true. But those who don't take care of themselves don't take care of themselves. You know, why is this a governmental problem? We have specialists who, of course, have their special interests. They'd love to see their whole area of study promoted. Okay. Other than that, we have bureaucrats with no expertise promoting this, calling for more money from the government. The government has no money. The fellows who were just talking are talking about all these things that are free.
Mm-hmm.
That's the greatest misnomer in our society. There's nothing for free. So now we are going to create a crisis, or we're going to focus on something that may be an issue, but it's certainly not a societal issue.
Peter, I take your point. I take your point. You know, nothing medical services aren't ultimately free. Somebody pays. On the other hand, obesity has, I believe, has its cost. But Kelly Brownell, let me put it to you. You know, is it a public problem? Should it? Is it properly a government problem or not? You hear Peter's skepticism.
Peter's opinion about this is not uncommon. And it's the way the country started dealing with the obesity problem was to take Peter's stance and say, let's focus on personal responsibility. It's an individual's problem, so let them solve it. But there are a few problems with that way of thinking. One is that the cost, the medical care costs, which are very, very high, about half of them are borne by each and every one of us through Medicare and Medicaid. And so your caller's point was, well, those are government programs we shouldn't have anyway. Well, you can argue that, I guess. But there are also these ripple effects into day-to-day life that really affect the economy and affect all of us in different ways. So, for example, overweight employees tend to have productivity issues, and so workplaces are affected. There are issues about whether children who are not nourished very well in schools or overnourished, how well are they learning? How does that affect our competition in the global marketplace? The military now is having a really hard time finding enough physically fit recruits to join. So there's so many areas of society that are affected by this that government has said, sitting by and hoping people will change their behavior and just imploring them to do so is not enough, that we need to get involved at a higher level, much like we did with tobacco. And that's why we're seeing all these efforts like what's happening in Oklahoma City and New York City.
What are the current trend lines nationally, Kelly? If obesity has risen, is it continuing to rise? And with what kinds of consequences for us if it does?
There's some indication in adults of a leveling off, but leveling off at a terrible number is still terrible. And the results with children are pretty discouraging. The results are continuing to go up. And if you extrapolate into healthcare costs later in life for those children who are overweight at a young age, it really is discouraging. And, of course, it affects not only things like healthcare costs, but the real lives of the people who are affected by this.
Peter, thanks for your call. Let me get another Shoshana here calling from Boston. Shoshana, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a big fan of your show, a WBUR member and listener.
Great.
What's frustrating me about this national debate about obesity is how it's focusing on the consumer demand and not the supply. So, in other words, we're talking about how to get people to buy healthier food, to eat healthier food, and how to exercise more, mm-hmm. which is all good and important. But then there's this whole other side to the problem where we have big government subsidies for big agribusiness, especially the corn and the corn lobby, subsidies that are making corn, which turns into all the cheap sugars that we have in sodas and in all the cheap carbs that are yeah. causing the obesity problem, it turns that food really cheap. So that a family trying to feed themselves goes into a store and finds that the most calories and the easiest accessible calories are calories that are causing obesity.
So you've got a government yeah. role on the supply side in terms of the kind
yeah.
and quality
and
of our food. So what would you do? Get government out of that or get it into the health problem prevention business?
Totally restructure the way that restructure food policy so that big agribusiness doesn't have as big of a hand in getting their food to be cheaper, which is then causing them to make a lot of money, but our bodies to take the brunt of that.
Thank you, Shoshana. Michael Bailey, when you're in this community, 73111 zip code, looking at what's widely available for people to eat, much of it, I suppose, subsidized by our government, does it look like a problem to you?
Yes, it does. 73111 is actually what we call a food desert. And when you roll down the street, what you see are fast food places. There's only one grocery store, and it's not what you'd call a supermarket in the area. And so, and as the caller just mentioned, it's actually cheaper, and if you're on a tight budget, it's cheaper actually to go to a fast food place and get a sandwich for a dollar that's full of all those extra carbs and been deep fried and have added sugar than it is to go to the grocery store.
And so when you try and get people to change their behavior, how do they do that? Where can they get the benefit? Are you saying grow it in your backyard? That's a good idea, but a lot of work.
Well, what we're trying to do is we've partnered with about 100 different other agencies here in this area, and so there are farmers markets with fresh vegetables cropping up all along the area. We've actually partnered with Women in Agriculture, who actually sells fresh produce that they grow here in the area. And what our program is not a diet program, a deprivation program.
Mm-hmm.
What it is, it talks about food portions and the types of food you eat. So we talk to them about healthy cooking and what they eat, but we also talk about the portion control, which you know is you go in these places and...
It's a big deal. The portions are too big, and we appreciate the work you're doing. Michael Bailey, county health worker in the Oklahoma City County Health Department. He's been going door-to-door in Oklahoma City's poorest neighborhood, promoting the city's health initiative, My Heart, My Health, My Family. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about New York's Big Gulp ban coming up, McDonald's calorie count. It'll be right up on the menu board now what all those sandwiches entail calorie-wise and what to really do about America's obesity crisis. We spoke with the mayor of Oklahoma City where they've done a lot of things. We spoke with Michael Bailey who works in the Oklahoma City County Health Department, and with us from New Haven, Connecticut, is Kelly Brownell. He's at Yale University, the Rudd's director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity there. Let's go to Tanya in Williamsville, New York. Tanya, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I'm enjoying the show, and I think this is a very important topic. I have a question for Kelly Bramell. Mm-hmm. He spoke about that if he had the if he had oversight over the funds that Oklahoma received, he would take a different approach, a broader approach, and he spoke about changing the environmental drivers. I'd like to know what change then would he implement?
We'll pick it right up. Kelly, thank you, Tanya. Kelly, this is so fascinating, you know, because here I am talking with Mayor of Oklahoma City about this campaign going on. He's done so much on weight, but doesn't want to be associated with health care reform money. You could hear him really peddling away from that. Then you've got Michael Bailey, good-hearted and out there in the street and working hard on it, and we hope that it succeeds. But I think I've seen your center, or maybe even you today, raising some questions about that kind of approach. What would you, with money and power or suasion, what would you do, Kelly? What really seems to work most effectively?
Well, some of the things I heard from Oklahoma City I think are great. So changing the infrastructure to create more opportunities to be physically active makes all the sense in the world, mm-hmm. because declining physical activity is one of the contributing factors to obesity. The food desert issue came up. If people choose to eat healthier foods, but they live in areas where the foods aren't available, what are they to do? And correcting that problem makes perfect sense. Those are helping address some of the drivers. But what hasn't come up yet are the unhealthy food drivers of this. The fact that unhealthy foods are marketed in tidal wave proportions to people. Children are receiving a massive amount of marketing for unhealthy foods. Portion sizes are multiples of what they used to be just several decades ago. The foods are priced in ways that encourages overconsumption. There are a number of these negative things. The heavy promotion of sugared beverages would be another example. And as long as these things are continuing, it's hard to imagine we can help address the obesity problem. I'll give you one example. Mm-hmm. Right now, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is by far the largest funder of work in the nation on childhood obesity, and they're devoting $100 million a year to the problem. This has been a godsend to those of us who care about the issue and really has made a big national difference in terms of awareness and attention to the issue. But the food industry spends that amount, $100 million, every year by January 4th, just marketing, just unhealthy food, just to children. So in the presence of such a toxic influence, how can you expect the small things that we're doing to work? So we really have to go on after the unhealthy food part of things. And that's where proposals like what Mayor Bloomberg does come in.
You're saying what? The reform, healthcare reform has $10 billion in prevention and public health fund to invest in community prevention. You're saying, well, you might be better off to go after the supply of food and do what? Tax it? Ban it? What?
Well, those all sound pretty severe, especially
that's
banning.
What Mayor Bloomberg is doing. He's banning the big drinks, right?
Well, what he's proposed is that no drinks be sold in places where the city has jurisdiction in containers larger than 16 ounces.
Yeah, that's a ban.
Now, it's pretty hard. Well, it's a ban of larger sizes. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't mean somebody can't buy two. Mm-hmm. It's not preventing people from buying the soda. But what it does is it discourages the overconsumption that larger containers promote. It's quite well known in scientific circles that if you serve people more food, they eat more food, and they generally don't recognize they've eaten more or report being any more full. And so there's no question that this upsizing that the food industry has very systematically done is contributing to overeating and hence to obesity. So something needs to be done about that, and that's what the mayor is trying to do.
So what else looks like most effective steps here?
Well, for example, let's go back to Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. Is the mayor doing anything to have less sales of sugar-sweetened beverages in municipal facilities, in public parks, in places where the city has authority, like stadiums perhaps, let's say? Mm-hmm. Has the mayor taken on foods in the Oklahoma City schools would be an example. Those are the sort of things that are helping contribute to the problem. And it's easier to do what the mayor's doing. Nobody's going to quarrel with you if you only focus on physical activity. And if you do these kind of campaigns to bring awareness to the obesity problem, then everybody is your friend. You don't have any enemies. But once you start going after the unhealthy food part of it, then you have major enemies, namely the big corporate food entities in the United States. Those things are harder, but I think ultimately you're probably going to have to be done, much like happened with tobacco, and that has been a huge public health success.
Our caller Peter said this is a personal responsibility. People should take care of it themselves. Are you suggesting that, in fact, as human consumers of food, we're not good at that? In fact, we're not up to the task, that there's got to be some kind of public health response because individually we just – too many of us go off the deep end, whatever we know about the dangers of weight?
Well, the way you phrased it, are we up to the task, I think is actually very apt in this case. The human body is prepared to deal with foods that are found in nature. And so when you have corn, for example, people don't overeat corn. But when it gets turned into snack foods like Cheetos, for example, what happens? Wheat, people don't abuse. But when it gets turned into Twinkies, what happens? Water, people don't overconsume, but what happens when it gets turned into Coke? You get the idea. Mm-hmm. The human body just wasn't biologically prepared for these very rapid changes in food technology that put our bodies out of touch with the environment. Now, we can just say that people need to stand up to this, and to some you can get some mileage out of that, but we've been doing that for a long time now, and obesity rates have just been increasing. So the question is, does government have a role with respect to personal responsibility? And the issue is unquestionably yes. Should the government undermine personal responsibility or support it? Well, in some ways, the government is undermining it. The subsidies that go to the farmers that produce the processed foods, as one of your callers said, is a problem. The fact that people, the companies are allowed to market the way they are is part of the problem. Unhealthy foods in schools is part of the problem. So if the government can do whatever it can to support personal responsibility and then give it a working chance, I mean a fair chance out there in the real world, then I think we've got hope of doing this. But some people want to hold back government from doing this, and I think that holds back personal responsibility.
Do we need to go as far as we went with tobacco? You treat bad food like we treated tobacco with all the warnings and big taxes that make it very difficult, you know, unattractive to buy.
Well, one of the issues we've been working on has been the idea of a tax. And this was an idea we introduced some 20 years ago and just languished around in the academic community, but then came into the public limelight in 2009 where a number of jurisdictions began considering a tax specifically on sugared beverages. And there are very good reasons for singling that out as a category, and I'll be happy to talk about that if you'd like. But part of the rationale for that is based on the big success in the tobacco arena. We have about half the people smoking in the U.S. now than used to be the case, and you can count the number of lives saved in the millions from that. And of all the different things that were done to curb tobacco, the high taxes on cigarettes was the one of the strongest drivers. So why doesn't it make sense to do something like tax sugared beverages? They have no nutrition. They're contributing to ill health to a large degree, and why not take some of the money that might be raised from a tax and do things like subsidize fruits and vegetables? Then government would be supporting personally responsible decisions.
And it's not like it's starting from a neutral position. As our caller pointed out, the government is now subsidizing foods that may end up having ill health effects. You talk about personal responsibility, and who's not all for it? But boy, these days you look around sometimes at kids, young kids who may be too young to really exercise that, and you see the kind of weight they're carrying already, and you imagine the lifetime implications for them. Let's get a call from New Orleans. Parisa is calling. Parisa, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am a young physician, and I am practicing here in New Orleans, and I'm relatively new in the South, and obesity is a tremendous problem in New Orleans, and I can't tell you how frustrating it is to attempt to treat hypertension, diabetes, even inflammatory conditions like cancer due to obesity when I feel like I'm putting a bandage on a broken bone. And I'm calling to say that I think education is key because I found my patients to be eager to receive nutritional education during the limited time I have with them. in clinic. And the one comment I like to make is it's not only about quantity, as you said, but it's about the quality and specifically the types of fats that are eaten. That, I think, is something that there's been a lot of miseducation and miscommunication about with the whole low-fat diet trend in the 90s that completely backfired. And more specifically, I like to mention omega-3 fatty acids. So, you know, people know it might have some properties for cardiac health, and it's found in fish oil. That's about as much as most people know about omega-3s. The thing with omega-3s is that they are essential fatty acids, meaning the body cannot synthesize them, but they were extracted out of the food supply in the 40s by food chemists seeking to prolong the shelf life of foods because they're the first fats to go rancid and they necessitate refrigeration. However, they were extracted out of the food supply before we realized they're essential and before we realized they're highly metabolically active tissues that are concentrated in the eyes, in the brain,
yeah,
the wings of hummingbirds and the tail of sperm. And we, not right now, by eating so much corn and grain and feeding our cattle corn, we are bioaccumulating omega-6 fatty acids. And omega-6 fatty acids, although they're essential as well, they are pro-inflammatory and pro-thrombotic, and they contribute to blood clots. And basically, we are eating a winter hibernation diet year-round.
Wow, Parisa, you are really sharp and really on top of this. I'll look at the omega-3 and 6 issue with Kelly Brunell. What do you think would help? Apart from the quality, clearly we need that. What do you think we should do as a society? Is there something we could do to get your patients out of that obesity trap so they're not coming to you with diabetes and obesity-related cancers?
You know, that's a very difficult question because nutritional education is even lacking in medical schools. I think this is changing. And the nutritional science is a rapidly advancing science as well. I think we need to turn, in general, you know, the price that people, the money people invest in buying medicines is money that can be invested in buying green leafy vegetables, walnuts and flaxseed, fish oil. Fish, the oceans are in a state of collapse, so I don't recommend fish oil, but I tell my patients to eat walnuts and dark leafy vegetables and flaxseed, and but all of which need to be refrigerated because they're go rancid and they're labile.
Parisa, we've got it, and I'm so grateful for your call from New Orleans. Kelly Brunell, how about it? Not just quantity, but quality, she's saying. Food science has extracted omega-3s from food, so we're on a winter diet and always feel like we're looking to hibernate on that diet.
The Parisa makes a very interesting point, that the food supply has changed and become unrecognizable in a variety of ways. And there are lots of things in the food supply where you could justifiably ask whether they're really food. I mean, they're concoctions of chemicals, and they're so highly processed that the body doesn't recognize them anymore. And it's important to focus in both the quality of food and its quantity and try to get better diets to people. And it's really nice to hear a young physician being motivated to help address this issue because physicians can play a very positive role in motivating and educating people. Now, there was one thing that did catch my attention, though, in what your caller said, mm-hmm. and that's the issue of education. Education sounds good and everybody believes in it, including me, but it can be quicksand in a way because you can spend a tremendous amount of money educating the public on the issues. And the question is, how much do you teach them beyond what they probably already know? Mm-hmm. Most people know that you should eat less junk food and exercise more and eat things like fruits and vegetables. So the rudiments of healthy behavior are there in most people. The question is, what's going on in the environment that makes it so hard for people to do those things? And that's where I think the attention might go.
Change the food environment. Let's get a call from Evansville, Indiana. Chris is calling. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I've got a question as far as regulating what you're able to purchase with food stamps or EBT.
Okay, what do you know?
One of my jobs, I work for a gas station, and we accept EBT. And I constantly get these, you know, younger women come in, and they purchase, you know, 32-ounce, 44-ounce soft drinks, junk food, you know, they get bags of chips, all kinds of stuff.
Buying on food stamps, you're saying, Chris?
Yes, using food stamps.
Yep.
And I didn't know if there's a way that they are able to regulate what you purchase with food stamps.
Chris, I appreciate your call. Our time is short. Kelly Burnell, there's the view right from the convenience store gas station where it's going on. What do you say to that?
There is a raging debate on this issue right now in the halls of Congress and elsewhere because public health advocates say that it doesn't make sense for government. Government buys somewhere between $2 and $4 billion worth of soda every year using through the food stamp program. And you have to wonder, does that make any sense at all, given that then government has to pay for the diseases that get caused by the overconsumption of these things? The hunger community has objections to this restriction approach because they say that the poor are already stigmatized, and this would further stigmatize them to remove this sort of pleasure opportunity from their lives by restricting the use of food stamps. And I see some legitimacy to that point of view as well. So it'll be interesting to see how this gets debated. But certainly it makes sense for agriculture policy, which is where food stamps are in the government, to line up with health policy so that government funds are used to encourage healthy rather than unhealthy eating.
But the bottom line I'm hearing from you, Kelly, and it's interesting, after all this concern, all these different efforts, I mean, we go round and round. People know what's wrong and they do it anyway. We get fatter and fatter. I hear you saying we've got to get smart about human nature and look at the food supply itself and what we're surrounding ourselves with if we're going to really have a shot at getting on top of this.
I think that's definitely true. You have to address the core drivers of the problem, and many of those are in the environment. As an example, if you have junk food in schools, kids will eat junk food in schools and their health will deteriorate. If you take it out, they'll eat a healthier diet. They don't make up for it by binging more later. So that would be an example of creating a better set of healthy conditions. Mm-hmm. And government's beginning to get involved in issues like this more and more and more, which I see as a very positive development.
We're out of time right there. Kelly Brownell at Yale University, thank you very much for your time today. We're on a learning curve here and a weight curve, too. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.